linen-covered duvet with me. I sweep it around my shoulders and drag myself to the door on legs that feel weak and watery. I fumble over the lock, finally get it switched, and the door swings open as if by magic, because that's how dreams work. Only when I see him standing on the other side of the door, hand still resting on its knob, beat-up suitcase behind him, I'm not so sure it's a dream anymore. "Oh, God, Poppy," he says, stepping in and examining me, the cool back of his hand pressing to my clammy forehead. "You're burning up." "You're in Norway," I manage in a raspy whisper.
"I'm definitely not."
He drags his bag inside and closes the door.
"When was the last time you took ibuprofen?"
I shake my head.
"Nothing,"
he says.
"Shit, Poppy, you were supposed to go to the doctor."
"I didn't know how to." It sounds so pathetic. I'm 26 years old with a full-time job and health insurance and an apartment and student loan bills, and I live alone in New York City, but there are just some things you don't want to have to do on your own.
"It's okay," Alex says, pulling me gently into him. "Let's get you back in bed and see if we can get rid of the fever."
"I have to pee," I say tearfully, then admit, "I may have already peed myself."
"Okay," he says. "Go pee. I'll find you some clean clothes."
"Should I shower?" I ask, because apparently I'm helpless. I need someone to tell me exactly what to do, like my mom used to do when I stayed home from middle school, watching Cartoon Network all day long, doing nothing for myself until she told me to.
"I'm not sure," he says. "I'll Google it. For now, just pee."
It takes way too much effort to get into the bathroom. I drop the blankets just outside it and pee with the door open, shivering the whole time, but comforted by the sound of Alex moving around in my apartment, quietly opening drawers, clicking on the gas stove top, moving the tea kettle onto it. He comes to check on me when he's finished with whatever he's doing, and I'm still sitting on the toilet with my sleep shorts around my ankles.
"I think you're okay to shower if you want to," he says, and starts the water up. "Maybe don't wash your hair. I don't know if that's a real thing, but Grandma Betty swears that wet hair makes you sick. Are you sure you won't fall down or anything?"
"If it's fast, I'll be okay," I say, suddenly aware of how sticky I feel. I am almost positive I wet myself. Later, this will probably be humiliating, but right now, I don't think anything could embarrass me. I'm just so relieved to have him here. He looks uncertain for a second.
"Just go ahead and get in. I'll stay close by, and if you feel like it's getting to be too much, just tell me, okay?"
He turns away from me while I force myself onto my feet and strip out of my pajamas. I climb into the hot water and pull the curtain closed, shuddering as the water hits me.
"You okay?" he asks immediately.
"Mm-hmm."
"I'm going to stay here, okay?" he says. "If you need anything, just tell me."
"Mm-hmm." After only a couple minutes, I've had enough. I turn off the water, and Alex passes me a towel. I'm colder than ever now that I'm all wet, and I step out with teeth chattering.
"Here."
He wraps another towel around my shoulders like a cape, tries to rub heat into them.
"Come sit in the room while I change your bedding, okay?"
I nod, and he leads me to the antique rattan peacock chair in the corner of my bedroom.
"Spare bedding?"
he asks. I point to the closet.
"Top shelf."
He gets it out and hands me a folded pair of sweatpants and a t-shirt. Since I don't have a habit of folding my clothes, he must have instinctively folded them when he got them out of the dresser. When I take them from him, he turns pointedly away from me to work on making the bed, and I drop the towels onto the floor and dress. When he's finished making the bed, Alex pulls back a corner of the bedding and I slide in, letting him tuck me in. In the kitchen, the kettle starts whistling. He turns to go for it, but I grab onto his arm, half drunk on the feeling of being warm and clean.
"I don't want you to go."
"I'll be right back, Poppy," he says. "I need to get you some medicine."
I nod, release him. When he comes back, he's carrying a glass of water and his laptop bag.
He sits on the edge of the bed and pulls out pill bottles and boxes of Mucinex, lining them up on the side table.
I wasn't sure what your symptoms were, he says.
I touch my chest, trying to explain how tight and awful it feels.
Got it, he says,
and he chooses a box, peels two pills out, and hands them to me with the glass of water.
Have you eaten? He asks when I've taken them.
I don't think so.
He gives a faint smile.
I grabbed some stuff on the way here so I wouldn't have to go back out. Does soup sound okay?
Why are you so nice?
I whisper. He studies me for a moment, then bends and presses a kiss to my forehead.
Think the tea will be ready by now.
Alex brings me chicken noodle soup and water and tea. He sets timers for when I'm able to take more medicine, checks my temperature every couple hours throughout the night. When I sleep, it's dreamless, and every time I stir awake, he's there, half snoozing on the bed beside me. He yawns himself awake, looks over at me.
How you doing?
Better,
I answer. And I'm not sure if it's true in a physical sense, but at least mentally, emotionally, I do feel better having him here, and I can only manage a word or two at a time, so there's no use explaining that. In the morning, he helps me down the stairs to a cab, and we go to the doctor. Pneumonia. I have pneumonia. Not the kind, though, that's so bad I need to be in a hospital.
As long as you keep an eye on her and she sticks to the antibiotics, she should be fine.
The doctor tells Alex more than me. I guess because I don't really look like the kind of person who can make sense of words right now. When Alex gets me home afterward, he tells me he has to go back out, and I want so badly to beg him to stay, but I'm just too tired. Besides, I'm sure he needs a break from my apartment and me after a whole night of playing nurse. He comes back half an hour later with Jell-O and ice cream, and eggs, and more soup, and all kinds of vitamins and spices I've never even considered keeping in my apartment before now.
Betty swears by zinc, he tells me when he brings me a handful of vitamins with a cup of red Jell-O and another glass of water. She also told me to put cinnamon in your soup, so if it tasted bad, blame her.
How are you here?
I struggle to get out.
The first leg of my flight to Norway was through New York, he says.
So what, I say. You panicked and left the airport instead of boarding the next plane?
No, Poppy, he says. I came here to be with you.
Immediately, tears spring into my eyes.
I was going to take you to a hotel made of ice.
A quick smile flits across his mouth.
I honestly don't know if that's the fever talking.
No.
I scrunch my eyes shut, feeling the tears cutting trails down my cheeks.
It's real. I'm so sorry.
Hey.
He brushes the hair out of my face.
You know I don't care about that, right? I only care about getting to spend time with you.
His thumb lightly traces the wet streak making its way down the side of my nose, heading it off just before it reaches my top lip.
I'm sorry you don't feel well and that you're missing the ice hotel, but I'm okay right here.
Every ounce of dignity obliterated by having had this man change my pea-drenched bedding, I reach up for his neck and pull him toward me. And he shifts onto the bed beside me, maneuvering close at the beckoning of my hands. He wraps an arm around my back and draws me into his chest, and I slip an arm around his waist, too, and we lie there, tangled together.
I can feel your heartbeat,
I tell him.
I can feel yours,
he says.
I'm sorry I peed the bed.
He laughs, squeezes me to him, and right then, my chest aches with how much I love him. I guess I must say something like this aloud, because he murmurs,
"That's probably the fever talking."
I shake my head, nestle closer until there are no spaces left between us. His hand moves lightly up into my hair, and a shiver runs down my spine from where his fingers trail along my neck. It feels so good in a sea of bad feelings that it makes me arch a little, my hand tightening on his back,
and I feel the way his heartbeat speeds, which only makes mine skyrocket to match it. His hand moves to my thigh, wrapping it around his hip, and my fingers twist against him as I bury my mouth against the side of his neck where I feel his pulse thudding urgently beneath it.
"Are you comfortable?"
he asks thickly, like our lying like this could just be a matter of alignment, like we're building up a narrative that protects us from the truth of what's happening, that even through the fog of being sick, I can feel him wanting me like I want him.
"Mm-hmm,"
I murmur.
"Are you?"
His hand tightens on my thigh, and he nods.
"Yeah,"
he says, and we both go very still. I don't know how long we lie there, but eventually the cold medicine wins out over the sparking, alert nerve endings in my body, and I fall asleep, only to find him safely on the other side of the bed the next time I wake up.
"You were asking for your mom," he tells me.
"Whenever I'm sick, I miss her,"
I say. He nods, tucks a strand of hair behind my ear.
"Sometimes I do too."
"Tell me about her,"
I ask. He shifts, lifting himself higher against the headboard.
"What do you want to know?"
"Anything,"
I whisper.
"What do you think about when you think about her?"
"Well, I was only 6 when she died,"
he says, smoothing my hair again. I don't argue or press for more, but eventually he goes on.
"She used to sing to us when she tucked us in at night, and I thought she had a beautiful voice. I mean, like, I would tell kids in my class that she was a singer, or she would have been if she wasn't a stay-at-home mom or whatever. And you know,"
his hand stills in my hair,
"my dad couldn't talk about her, like, at all. I mean, he still can't really without breaking down. So growing up, my brothers and I didn't talk about her either. And when I was probably 14, 15, I went over to Grandma Betty's house to clean her gutters and mow her lawn and stuff. And she was watching these old home movies of my mom."
I study his face, the way his full lips curl and his eyes catch the streaks of streetlight coming through my window so that he almost looks lit from within.
"We never did that at my house," he says. "I couldn't even remember what she sounded like. But we watched this video of her holding me as a baby, singing this old Amy Grant song."
His eyes cut to me, his smile deepening in one corner.
"And her voice was horrible."
"How horrible are we talking here?"
I ask.
"Bad enough that Betty had to turn it off so she didn't have a heart attack from laughing," he says. "And you could tell Mom knew she was bad. I mean, you could hear Betty laughing while she filmed, and my mom kept looking over her shoulder with this grin, but she didn't stop singing. I guess I think about that a lot."
"She sounds like my kind of lady," I say.
"For most of my life," he says, "she's kind of felt like this boogeyman, you know? Like the biggest part she's played in my life is just how wrecked my dad was from losing her, how scared he was to have to raise us on his own."
I nod. Makes sense.
"A lot of times when I think about her, it's like,"
he pauses,
"she's more a cautionary tale than a person. But when I think about that video, I think about why my dad loved her so much. And that feels better, to think about her as a person."
For a while, we're quiet. I reach over and fold Alex's hand in mine.
"She must have been pretty amazing," I say, "to make a person like you."
He squeezes my hand, but doesn't say another word, and eventually I drift back to sleep. The next 2 days are a blur, and then I'm on the rise. Not healthy, but more awake, lighter, clearer headed. There's no more intense cuddling, just a lot of watching old cartoons together on the bed, sitting out on the fire escape in the morning while we eat breakfast, taking pills whenever the alarms go off on Alex's phone, drinking tea on the sofa at night with a playlist of traditional Norwegian folk music playing in the background. 4 days pass, then 5. And then I'm doing well enough that I could theoretically leave the country, but it's too late,
and there's no more talk of it. There's no more touching either, except the occasional bump of the arm or leg, or the compulsive reach across the table to stop me from spilling on my chin. At night, though, when Alex is lying on the far side of my bed, I stay awake for hours, listening to his uneven breath, feeling like we're two magnets trying desperately to draw together. I know, deep down, that it's not a good idea. The fever lowered my defenses, and his too, but when it comes down to it, Alex and I are not for each other. There might be love and attraction and history, but that just means there's more to lose if we try to take this friendship into a place it doesn't belong. Alex wants marriage and kids and a home in one place, and he wants it all with someone like Sarah, someone who can help him build the life that he lost when he was 6 years old. And I want a tetherless life of spontaneous trips and exciting new relationships, different seasons with different people, and quite possibly to never settle down. Our only hope of maintaining this relationship is through the platonic friendship we've always had. That 5% has been creeping up for years, but it's time to tamp it back down, to squash the what if. At the end of the week, when I drop him off at the airport, I give him the most chaste hug I can muster, despite the way that his lifting me against him sends that same spine-arching shiver down my back and heat pooling in all the places he's never touched me. "I'll miss you," he says in a low growl against the side of my ear, and I force myself to step back a sensible distance. "You too." I think about him all night. And when I dream, he's pulling my thigh over his leg, rolling his hips against mine. Every time he's about to kiss me, I wake up. We don't talk for 4 days, and when he finally texts me, it's just a picture of his tiny black cat sitting on an open copy of Wise Blood by Flannery O'Connor. "Fate," he writes. 26. This summer. Standing on the balcony, our rain-drenched bodies flush, his gaze soft, I feel my last vestige of self-control washing off me, rinsed clear along with the desert heat and grime of the day. There's nothing left but Alex and me. His lips press closed, then part, and mine mirror them, his breath warm against my mouth. Every shallow inhale I take draws us a little closer until my tongue just barely grazes his rain-dampened bottom lip, and then he adjusts to catch my mouth just a little more with his. A fraction of a kiss, and then another one a bit fuller. A twist of my hands in his hair, the hiss of breath between his teeth, and then another brush of his lips, deeper, slower, careful and intent, and I'm melting against him, shivering and terrified and exhilarated and every shade between as our mouths sink together and pull apart, his tongue sliding over mine for a second, then a little deeper, my teeth catching on the fullest part of his bottom lip, his hands moving down my hips, my chest arching up into his as my hands glide down his wet neck. We come together and apart. The little gaps and short, breathless inhalations nearly as intoxicating as each taste, test, scrape of his rain-slicked mouth moving over mine. He draws back, leaves his mouth just hovering over mine, where I can still feel his breath.
"Is this okay?"
he asks me in a hush. If I could speak, I'd tell him this is the best kiss I've had in my entire life, that I didn't know just kissing could feel this good, that I could just make out with him for hours and it would be better than the best sex I've ever had. But I can't think clearly enough to say any of this. My mind is too busy with the grip of his hands on my ass and the feel of his chest flattening mine out, his wet skin and the thin, drenched clothes between us. So I just nod and catch his bottom lip between my teeth again, and he turns me against the stucco wall, presses me back into it as he kisses me more urgently. One of his hands twists into the hem of my t-shirt where it hangs against my thigh, and the other grazes up my stomach beneath it.
What about this?
He asks.
Yes,
I breathe. His hand lifts higher, slips under my bathing suit top, making me shiver.
This,
he says. My breath catches. Heart stumbles over a beat as his fingers lightly circle. I nod, pull his hips back to mine. He's hard between my legs, and instantly I feel a little lightheaded.
I think about you all the time,
he says, and kisses me slowly, drags his mouth down my neck, goosebumps fluttering out in his wake.
I think about this.
I do too,
I admit in a whisper. His mouth moves over my chest, kissing me through my wet t-shirt, even as his hands work the fabric up over my hips, my ribs, and then my shoulders. He pulls away long enough to peel it over my head and discard it among the plastic sheeting.
Yours too,
I say, heart leaping. I reach for the hem of his shirt, pull it over his head. When I toss it aside, he tries to move toward me, but I hold him back for a second.
Do you want to stop?
He asks, his eyes dark. I shake my head.
I just never get to look at you like this.
The corner of his mouth twitches into a smile.
You could have always looked,
he says in a low voice.
Just so you know.
Well, you could have too, I say.
Trust me,
he says.
I did.
And then I'm dragging him in against me, and he's roughly lifting my thigh against his hip, and I'm sinking my fingers into his wide back, my teeth into his neck, and his hands are massaging my chest, my ass. His mouth moves down my collarbone, sliding under my bikini, teeth careful on my nipple, and I'm feeling him through his shorts, then reaching into them, loving how he tenses and shifts. I push his shorts down over his hip bones, my mouth going dry at the feeling of him against me.
Shit,
I say, a realization hitting me like a bucket of ice water.
I went off birth control.
If it helps, he says, I had a vasectomy.
I draw back, shocked out of the moment.
You what?
They're reversible,
he says, blushing for the first time since we started this.
And I took precautions in case I want kids and the reversal doesn't work. They usually do, but anyway, I just didn't want to accidentally get someone pregnant. I'm still always safe. It's not like, why are you looking at me like that?
I knew Alex was a black and white thinker. I knew he was ultra cautious, and I knew he was the most thoughtful, courteous person on the planet. But somehow, I'm still surprised all of that added up to this big decision. It makes my heart feel like a sore muscle, all heat and achy tenderness, because it is just so him. I tighten my arms around his waist, squeeze him to me.
It's just that of course you did that,
I say. Above and beyond caution and consideration. You're a prince, Alex Nilsson.
Uh-huh,
he says. His expression both amused and unconvinced.
I'm serious, I say, pressing closer. You're incredible.
We can find a condom if you want,
he says.
But I'm not. There's no one else.
I'm sure I'm blushing now and probably smiling ridiculously.
That's okay, I say. It's just us.
What I mean to say is, if there's anyone I would do this with, it would be him. If there's one person I truly trust, want all of in this way, it's him. But that's how I say it. It's just us. And he says it back to me, like he knows exactly what I mean. And then we're on the ground in a sea of discarded plastic, and he's tearing my top off, pulling my bottoms off too, pressing his mouth between my legs, clutching my ass in his hands, making me gasp and rise against him as his tongue moves over me.
Alex,
I plead, knotting my hands into his hair.
Stop making me wait for you.
Stop being impatient,
he teases.
I've waited 12 years. I want this to last.
A shiver races down my spine and I arch into him.
Finally, he crawls up the length of me, hands tangling in my hair, roaming over my skin, and he slowly pushes into me. We find our rhythm together, and it all feels so good, so electric, so right, that I can't believe all the time we wasted not doing this. 12 years of subpar lovemaking when all along this was how it was supposed to be. God, how are you so good at this? I say, and his laugh grates against my ear as he kisses behind it.
Because I know you, he says tenderly. And I remember what you sound like when you like something.
Everything in me pulls taut in waves. Every move of his hands, every thrust threatens to unravel me. I could have sex with you until I die, I pant.
Good,
he says, and he moves a little faster, harder, the intense pleasure of it making me buck and swear and move to match him. I love you, I hiss by accident. I think I meant to say, I love having sex with you, or I love your amazing body. Or maybe I did mean to say, I love you, the same way I always say it to him when he does something thoughtful. But this is a little bit different, because we're having sex, and my face goes hot, and I'm not sure how to fix it, but then Alex just sits up and draws me into his lap, holding me close as he pushes into me again, slow, deep, hard, and says,
I love you too.
And all at once, my chest loosens, my stomach unwinds, and any embarrassment and fear evaporates. There's nothing left but Alex. Alex's rough hands moving gently through my hair. Alex's wide back rippling under my fingers. Alex's sharp hips working slowly, purposefully against mine. Alex's sweat and skin and raindrops on my tongue. His perfect arms holding on to me, keeping me there against him as we rock and clutch. His sensual lips tugging at my mouth, coaxing it open to taste me as we draw together and apart, finding new ways to touch and kiss each other every time we reunite. He kisses my jaw, my throat, my shoulder, his tongue hot and careful against my skin. I touch and taste every hard line and soft curve of him I can get to, and he shivers under my hands, my mouth. He lies back and draws me on top of him, and this is the best yet, because I can see so much of him, get to every place I want. Alex Nilsson, I say breathlessly, you are the hottest man alive. He laughs just as breathlessly and kisses the side of my neck.
And you love me.
My stomach flutters. I love you, I murmur, this time on purpose.
I love you so much, Poppy,
he says, and somehow just the sound of his voice tips me over the edge and I'm coming undone. We are together. And I don't know what we've done, what chain reaction we might have just triggered, how this will all pan out. But right then, I can't think about anything else but the crush of love looping between us. 27. This summer. Afterward, we lie on the plastic-strewn balcony, curled together and soaked to the bone, though already the storm is breaking up, the heat pushing in to burn the moisture off our skin. A long time ago, you told me that outdoor sex wasn't all it was cracked up to be, I say, and Alex gives a hoarse laugh, his hand smoothing my hair.
I hadn't had outdoor sex with you, he says.
That was amazing, I say. I mean, for me. It's never been like that for me before. He props himself up and looks down at me.
It's never been like that for me either.
I turn my face into his skin and kiss his ribcage. Just making sure. After a few seconds, he says,
I want to do it again.
Me too, I say. I think we should.
Just making sure,
he parrots. I draw lazy patterns over his chest, and the arm he has slung low across my back squeezes tight.
We really can't stay here tonight.
I sigh. I know. I just don't want to move ever again. He flips my hair behind my shoulder, then kisses the skin left exposed there. Do you think that would have happened if Nikolai's AC hadn't gone out? I ask.
Now, Alex leans to kiss me right over the heart, sending chills down my stomach and up my legs that his fingers trace over.
That would have happened if Nikolai had never been born. It just might not have happened on this balcony.
I sit up and swing one knee over his waist, settling onto his lap.
I'm glad it did.
His hands run up my thighs, and heat gathers anew between my legs. That's when we hear the pounding on the door.
Anyone home? A man shouts. It's Nikolai. I'm gonna let myself...
Hold on a sec!
I yell and scramble off Alex, snatching the wet t-shirt up.
Shit,
Alex says, searching for his swim trunks in the jumble of plastic sheeting. I find the wad of black fabric and shove it toward him, then pull the hem of my shirt down over my thighs just as the door's starting to unlock.
Hey, Nikolai!
I call way too loudly, heading him off before he can see either literally naked Alex or the shredded plastic. Nikolai is short and balding, dressed in an entirely maroon outfit, 70s-style golf shirt, pleated pants, loafers. He sticks one meaty hand out.
You must be Poppy.
Yes, hi.
I shake his hand and hold intense eye contact, hoping to give Alex a chance to discreetly get dressed out on the mostly dark balcony.
Look, I'm afraid it's bad news, he says. The AC's out.
No shit, I just barely keep myself from saying.
Not just for this unit, but this whole wing, he says. We've got someone coming out first thing in the morning, but I feel real bad about the delay.
Alex appears at my shoulder. At this point, Nikolai seems to clock that we're both soaking wet and rumpled, but luckily he says nothing about it.
Anyway, I feel real, real bad, he repeats. I thought you two were just being difficult, to be quite frank, but when I got here...
He tugs on the collar of his shirt and shudders.
Anyway, I'm refunding you for the last 3 days, and... Well, I hesitate to tell you to come back tomorrow in case things don't get sorted out.
That's fine, I say. If you refund the whole trip, we'll find someplace else to stay.
You sure? He says. Things can get pretty pricey when you book last minute like that.
We'll figure something out, I insist.
Alex bumps an arm against my back.
Poppy's an expert on traveling on the cheap.
That so?
Nikolai couldn't sound less interested. He pulls out his phone and types with one finger.
Refunds issued. Not sure how long it'll take, so let me know if there's a problem.
Nikolai turns to go, but swivels back.
Almost forgot. Found this on the welcome mat outside.
He hands us a piece of paper folded in half. In looping cursive, it says on the front, "The Newlyweds," with like 25 little hearts drawn around it.
Congrats on the nuptials,
Nikolai says, and lets himself out.
What is it?
Alex asks. I unfold the piece of paper. It's a Groupon printed in shoddy black ink. At the top, scrawled in the margin in the same handwriting as on the front, is a note.
Hope y'all don't think it's creepy we figured out what apartment you were in. We thought we might have heard the sounds of passion coming from this one, winky face. Also, Bob said he saw you leaving this morning. We are three doors down. Anyway, we have to take off bright and early for the next stage of our vacation. Joshua Tree, yay! I feel like a celebrity just writing that, and unfortunately we never got a chance to use this. Barely made it out of our bedroom. You two will know how it is, LOL. Hope y'all have a great rest of your trip. XOXO, your fairy godparents, Stacy and Bob.
I blink at the voucher, stunned. It's a $100 gift certificate, I say. For a spa. I think I read about this place. It's supposed to be amazing.
Wow, Alex says. Feeling kind of bad I didn't even remember their names.
They didn't address it to us directly, I point out. I doubt they know ours either.
And yet they gave us this anyway,
Alex says. I wonder if there's a way we could create a long-lasting friendship with them, get super close, take trips together, all of it, and keep them from ever finding out our names, just for fun.
We absolutely could,
Alex says.
You just have to make it long enough that it's too awkward to ask. I had so many friends like that in college.
Oh, God, yeah. And then you have to use that trick where you ask two people if they've been introduced and wait for them to say their names.
Except sometimes they just say yes.
Alex points out. Or they say no, but just keep waiting for you to introduce them.
Maybe they're doing the exact same thing, I say. Maybe those people don't even remember their names.
Well, I doubt I'll ever forget Stacy and Bob now,
Alex says. I doubt I'll forget much about this trip, I say. Except the gift shop and the dinosaur. That can go if I need to make room for more important things. Alex smiles down at me.
Agreed.
After an awkward beat of silence, I say, so, should we find a hotel? 28. This summer. The Lorea Palm Springs Hotel is $70 a night in the summer, and even in the dark, it looks like a kid's magic marker drawing, in a good way. The outside is an explosion of colors, banana yellow pool cabanas, hot sauce red chaises lined up around the water, each block of the three-story building painted a different shade of pink, red, purple, yellow, green. The room we check into is every bit as lively. Orange walls and drapes and furniture, green carpet, striped bedding match to the building's exterior. Most important, it's very cold.
You want to shower first?
Alex asks as soon as we're inside. I realize then that the whole drive over, and before that when we were packing our stuff up, tidying Nikolai's apartment, he's been waiting to be clean, suppressing a desire to say over and over again, God, I need a shower, while all I was doing was thinking about what happened on the balcony and going hot all over. I don't want Alex to go take a shower right now. I want to get in the shower together and make out some more. But I also remember him confiding once that he hated shower sex, worse than outdoor sex, because when he was in the shower, he just wanted to be clean, and that was hard to do with someone else's hair and dirt pouring down you, while the sex part was just as challenging because there was constantly soap in your eyes, or you were brushing up against the wall and thinking about the last time the tiles were cleaned, etc., etc., etc. So I just say, go for it. And Alex nods, but hesitates, like maybe he's going to say something, but ultimately decides not to, and disappears into the bathroom for a long, hot shower. My t-shirt and hair have both dried out, and when I go to sit out on the non-plastic-wrapped balcony of our new room, I realize that's already mostly dry, too. Any sign of the rain that broke the heat has burned off, like it never happened. Except that my lips feel bruised, and my body is more relaxed than I've been all week. And the air is lighter, too, breezy even.
All yours, Alex says behind me.
When I turn, he's standing there in his towel, looking shiny, clean, and perfect. My pulse quickens at the sight of him, but I'm aware of how filthy I am, so I swallow my want, stand up, and say, cool, too loudly. To put it lightly, I don't enjoy showering. Being clean, yes. The act of being in the shower, also yes. But everything about having to brush out my tangled hair beforehand, stepping out onto a ratty bath mat or tile floors, getting dry, combing my hair out again, I hate all of that, which means I'm a 3-shower-a-week person to Alex's 1 or 2 showers a day. But taking this shower, after the week we've had so far, is absolutely luxurious. Standing in hot, hot water within a cold, cold bathroom, watching legitimate dirt and grime drip off me and swirl around the drain in shimmery gray spirals is life-giving. Massaging coconut-scented shampoo into my scalp and green tea-scented cleanser onto my face and running a cheapo razor up my legs feels divine. It's the longest shower I've taken in months, and when I finally emerge from the bathroom, feeling like a new woman, Alex is fast asleep in one of the beds, on top of the bedding, with all the lights still on. For a second, I debate which bed to climb into. In general, I love being able to sprawl out in a queen bed on these trips, but there's a big portion of me that wants to curl up next to Alex, fall asleep with my head in the crook of his shoulder where I can smell his clean bergamot smell, maybe conjure up a dream about him. In the end, though, I decide it's too creepy to assume he wants to share a bed with me just because we hooked up. The last time anything happened between us, there certainly wasn't any bed sharing afterward. There was just chaos. I'm determined that this won't end up like that. No matter what happened or happens between us on this trip, I won't let it ruin our friendship. I won't make assumptions about what any of this means or foist any expectations onto Alex. I pull the striped comforter up over him, flick off the lights, and climb into the empty bed across from his. 29. 3 summers ago. Hey, Alex texts me the night before we leave for Tuscany. Hey yourself, I write back. Can you talk for a sec? Just want to finalize some stuff. Immediately, I think he's calling to cancel, which doesn't make sense. For the first time in years, we're set to have a tension-free trip. We're both in committed relationships, our friendship is better than ever, and I have never been so happy in my life. 3 weeks after my pneumonia debacle, I met Trey. A month after that, Alex and Sarah were back together. He says it's better this time, that they're on the same page. Nearly as important, this time around, she seems to have finally started warming to me, and the few times that Alex and Trey have met, they've gotten along too. So once again, as always, I've come to the place of being so, so ecstatically happy that Alex and I never let anything happen between us. I start to text him back, then decide to just call him from the folding chair on my balcony instead, since I'm home alone. Trey's still at Good Boy Bar, up the street from my new apartment, but I came home early after a bout of nausea, a warning sign of an oncoming migraine I need to fight off before our flight. Alex answers on the second ring, and I say, "Everything okay?" I can hear his turn signal going. Okay, so maybe we're back to him calling me from the car, on his way home from the gym, but things really do seem better. For one thing, they sent me a joint birthday card and Christmas card. She not only followed me back on Instagram, but she likes my photos, even comments little hearts and smiley faces on some of them. So I thought things were good, but now Alex skips right over hello and goes straight to, "We're not making a mistake, are we?" I say, "What?"
"I mean, a couple's trip. That's sort of intense."
I sigh. "How so?"
"I don't know."
I can hear the anxiety in his voice, imagine him grimacing, tugging at his hair.
"Trey and Sarah have only met once."
In the spring, Trey and I flew to Linfield so he could meet my parents. Dad wasn't impressed by the tattoos, or the holes in Trey's ears from the gauges he got when he was 17, or that he turns Dad's questions around on him, or that he doesn't have a degree. But Mom was impressed by his manners, which really are top-notch. Although I think for her it had more to do with the juxtaposition of his appearance with his easy, warm way of saying things like, "Excellent s'mores cake, Ms. Wright," and "Can I help you with the dishes?" By the end of the weekend, she'd decided he was a very nice young man, and when I sneaked out onto the deck to get Dad's opinion while Trey and Mom were inside dishing up homemade funfetti cake, Dad looked me in the eye with a solemn nod and said,
"I suppose he seems right for you. And he obviously makes you happy, Pop. That's all that matters to me."
He does make me happy. So happy. And he is right for me. Freakily so. I mean, we work together. We get to spend pretty much every day together, either in the office or halfway around the world. But we're also both independent, like having our own apartments, our own friends. He and Rachel get along, but when Trey and I are in the city, he's mostly hanging with his skateboarding friends while Rachel and I are trying a new brunch place or reading in the park or having our whole bodies scrubbed raw in our favorite Korean spa. 2 days home in Linfield and both of us were already a little restless, but he didn't mind the mess and he liked the menagerie of dying animals and he joined right in when we did a new talent show over Skype with Parker and Prince. Still, after how everything went down with Guillermo, and pretty much everyone else in the entire world, I was restless, eager to get out of Linfield before something scared Trey off. So we probably would have headed back early, if not for the fact that it was Mr. Nilsson's 60th birthday, and Alex and Sarah were coming down to surprise him with a visit. We decided the four of us should grab dinner before the party.
I'm so excited to meet this guy,
Trey kept saying whenever a new text came in from Alex, and every time it made my nerves inch closer to the surface. I felt fiercely protective. I just wasn't sure over whom. Just give him a chance, I kept saying. He takes a while to open up.
I know, Trey insisted. But I know how much he means to you, so I'm going to like him, P, I promise.
Dinner was okay. I mean, the food was great, Mediterranean, but the conversation could have been better. Trey, I couldn't help but think, came off a little show-offy when Alex asked him what he'd studied, but I knew his lack of formal education was something of a chip on his shoulder, and I wished there was some easy way for me to signal that to Alex as Trey launched into the story of how it all happened, how he'd been in a metal band all through high school back in Pittsburgh, how they'd taken off when he was 18, gotten offered an opening slot on the tour of a much bigger band. Trey was an amazing drummer, but what he really loved was photography. When his band broke up after 4 years of near-constant touring, he took a job taking pictures on another band's tour. He loved traveling, meeting people, seeing new cities, and as those connections built up, other job offers rolled in. He went freelance, eventually started working with R&R, and then came on as a staff photographer. He finished his monologue by putting an arm around my shoulders and saying, "And then I met P." The flicker on Alex's expression was so subtle, I was sure Trey didn't notice it. Maybe Sarah hadn't either, but to me, it felt like a pocket knife plunging into my belly button and dragging upward 5 or 6 inches.
"So sweet,"
Sarah said in her saccharine voice, and probably my face made a much bigger twitch.
"The funny thing is," Trey said then, "we were supposed to meet sooner. I was scheduled to go on that Norway trip with you two, before she got sick." "Wow."
Alex's eyes flicked to mine, then dipped the glass of water in front of him. It was sweating as badly as I was. He picked it up, slowly sipped, set it down.
"That is funny. Anyway," Trey said awkwardly, "what about you? What did you study?"
Trey knew exactly what Alex had gone to school for, was still going to school for, but I figured that by phrasing it as a question, he was giving Alex a chance to talk more about himself. Instead, Alex took another sip and said only,
"Creative writing, then literature."
I had to sit and watch my boyfriend struggle to find an appropriate follow-up question, give up, and go back to studying the menu. "He's an amazing writer," I said awkwardly, and Sarah shifted in her seat.
"He is," she said, her tone so acidic you'd think I'd just said Alex Nilsson has an incredibly sexy body.
After dinner, we went to the party at Grandma Betty's house, and things improved a bit. Alex's goofy brothers were all clamoring to meet Trey, bombarding him with all kinds of questions about the band and R&R and whether I snored.
"Alex would never tell us," the youngest, David, said. "But I assume Poppy sounds like a machine gun when she sleeps."
Trey laughed, took it all in stride. He's never jealous. Neither of us can afford to be. We are both relentless flirts. It sounds strange, but I love that about him. I love watching him go up to the bar to order me a drink and seeing how the bartenders smile and laugh, lean across the bar to bat their eyelashes at him. I love watching him charm his way through every city we go to, and that whenever he's next to me, he's touching me, an arm around the shoulders, a hand on my low back, or pulling me into his lap like we're home alone rather than dining at a 5-star restaurant. I've never felt so secure, so sure that I'm on the same page as someone. At the party, he kept his hands on me at all times, and David teased us about it.
"You don't think she's going to make a run for it if you let go, do you?" he joked. "Oh, she'll definitely make a run for it," Trey said. "This girl can't sit still for longer than 5 minutes. That's one thing I love about her."
The party was the first time all of Alex's brothers had been in the same place in a long time, and they were as rowdy and sweet as I remembered them being when Alex and I were 19, home from college and charged with driving them around in Alex's car,
since none of them had their own yet, and their dad was a sweet man, but also a forgetful, flaky one who was incapable of keeping track of who needed to be where and when. While Alex had always been calm and still by default, his brothers were the kind of boys who never stopped wrestling or giving one another wet willies. Even though some of them have kids now, they were still like that at the party. Mr. and Mrs. Nielsen had named them in alphabetical order. Alex first, then Bryce, then Cameron, then David. And weirdly, they're mostly sized like that too, with Alex the tallest and broadest, Bryce just as tall but lanky and narrow-shouldered, Cameron a few inches shorter and thick. Then there's David, who's an inch taller than Alex, with the build of a professional athlete. They're all handsome, with varying shades of blonde hair and matching hazel eyes, but David looks like a movie star, which lately, Alex said at dinner, he's been talking about moving to LA to become, with his thick, wavy hair and wide, thoughtful eyes, and his excitability, the way he lights up whenever he starts talking. He starts 50% of his sentences with the name of whoever he's addressing, or whoever he thinks will be most interested. "Poppy, Alex brought a bunch of issues of R&R home so I could read your articles," he said at one point at Betty's house, and that was the first time I found out Alex even read my articles. "They're really good. They make me feel like I'm there." "I wish you were," I told him. "Sometime we should all take a trip together." "Hell yeah," David said, then looked over his shoulder, grinning as he checked whether his dad had heard him swear. He's a 21-year-old baby, and I love him. At some point, Betty asked for my help in the kitchen, and I followed her in to put candles in the German chocolate cake she had baked for her son-in-law. "Your young man, Trey, seems like a nice one," she told me without looking up from what she was doing. "He's great," I said. "And I like his tattoos," she added. "They're just beautiful." She wasn't being an asshole. Betty could be sarcastic, but she could also catch you off guard with her opinions on certain things. She was changeable. I liked that about her. Even at her age, she asked questions in conversation like she didn't already have all the answers. "I like them too," I said. I was attracted to Trey's energy more than his appearance during our first work trip together, Hong Kong, and I liked that he waited to ask me out until we were home because he didn't want to make anything weird for me if I said no. I'd be lying, though, if I said Alex played no part in my saying yes. He'd just told me that he and Sarah had been talking a lot more at work, that things seemed okay between them. At that point, I was still regularly waking up from dreams about him showing up at my door, looking sleepy and worried and too comforting while I was in the throes of a fever. It didn't matter that he'd said nothing about getting back together with Sarah. He would or he wouldn't, but in the end, there would be someone, and I didn't think my heart could take it. So I said yes to Trey that night, and we went to a bar with free skee ball and hot dogs, and by the end of that night, I knew I could fall in love with him. Trey was to me what Sarah Torval was to Alex, someone who fit. So I kept saying yes. "Do you love him?" Betty asked me, still not looking up from the task at hand. I had the sense that she was giving me a level of privacy, the option to lie without her looking straight into my eyes if that was what I needed. But I didn't need to lie. "I do." "Good, honey. That's great." Her hands stilled, holding two thin silver candles into the frosting like they might try to jump out. "Do you love him like you love Alex?" I remember with vivid clarity the feeling of my heart stumbling over its next several beats. That question was more complicated, but I couldn't lie to her. "I don't think I'll ever love anyone the way I love Alex," I said. And then I thought, but maybe I won't ever love anyone like I love Trey either. I should have said it, but I didn't. Betty shook her head and looked me in the eye. "Wish he knew that." Then she walked out of the kitchen, leaving me to follow. Alex and Sarah had brought Flannery O'Connor with them, and she chose that moment to make her dramatic entrance, walking up to me with her spine arched up and eyes wide, staring into my face and meowing loudly in a full-body expression that Alex and I call Halloween Kitty. "Hi," I said, and she rubbed against my legs, so I reached to pick her up, and she hissed and swung a handful of claws toward me just as Sarah walked into the kitchen with a stack of dirty dishes. She laughed and said in that sweet voice of hers, "Wow, she does not like you." So, yes, I see where Alex is coming from with his nerves about this couple's trip, but we're making progress. With the Instagram likes and the perfectly pleasant time Trey, Alex, and I had at an arcade bar the last time Alex visited. And besides, being in the Tuscan countryside with an IV drip of incredible wine is not going to be the same as one awkward dinner in Ohio followed by a 60-year-old teetotaler's birthday party. "They're going to get along great," I tell him now, propping my legs up on the balcony railing and adjusting the phone between my face and shoulder. I hear his turn signal click off, and he sighs.
"How can you be sure?"
"Because we love them," I reason. "And we love each other, so they'll love each other. And we'll just all love each other. You and Trey, me and Sarah."
He laughs. "I wish you could hear how much your voice changed for that last part. It sounded like you were inhaling helium."
"Look, I'm still working on forgiving her for dumping you the last time," I say. "It seems like she's figured out that was the biggest mistake of her life, though, so I'm giving her a chance."
"Poppy," he says, "it wasn't like that. Things were complicated, but they're better now."
I know," I say, even though, really, I don't. He insists there are no hard feelings between them about their last breakup, but whenever I think about what she said, that their relationship was about as exciting as the school library where they'd met, I still see red for a second. Another wave of nausea hits me, and I groan.
"I'm sorry," I say. "I really need to go to bed so I can be flight ready tomorrow, but I'm telling you, this trip is going to be amazing." "Yeah," he says stiffly. "I'm sure I'm worrying for nothing."
Mostly, it turns out that's true. We're staying in a villa. It's hard to be in a bad mood when you're staying in a villa with a gleaming pool and old stone patio, an outdoor kitchen with bougainvillea dripping all over everything in soft pinks and purples.
"Wow, okay," Sarah says when we walk in. "I'm never missing one of these trips again."
I flash Alex a look that's the facial equivalent of a thumbs up, and he smiles faintly back.
"I know, right?" Trey says. "We should have thought to take a group trip sooner."
"Definitely," Sarah says,
though obviously with her schedule at a high school and Alex's teaching course load at the university, it's not like they've got much time to jet set around, even for steeply discounted Tuscan villas.
"There are like 10 Michelin-starred restaurants within 20 miles of here, and I figured Alex would want to cook one night at least."
"That'd be amazing," Alex agrees.
Sure, it's a little stiff and awkward that first day at the villa, as the four of us meander around between jet-lagged naps in our rooms and quick dips in the pool. Trey shoots some test photos, and I go into town to grab snacks. Aged cheeses and meats, fresh bread, and a variety of jams in tiny jars. And wine. Plenty of wine. By the end of the first night, sitting outside on the terrace and drinking the first two bottles of wine, everyone has softened, loosened. Sarah's become downright chatty, telling stories about her students, about Flannery O'Connor and life in Indiana, and Alex offers quiet, dry asides that make me laugh so hard wine spews out of my nose twice. It feels like the four of us are friends, real friends. When Trey pulls me into his lap and rests his chin on my shoulder, Sarah touches her chest and awes.
"You two are so sweet," she says, looking to Alex. "Aren't they sweet?"
"And buttery,"
Alex says, just barely glancing my way.
"What?" Sarah says. "What's that supposed to mean?"
He shrugs, and she goes on.
"I wish Alex liked PDA. We barely even hug in public."
"I'm not a big hugger,"
Alex says, embarrassed.
I didn't grow up hugging.
Yeah, but it's me, Sarah says. I'm not some girl you met at a bar, babe. Now that I think of it, I'm not sure I've seen him and Sarah touch. But it's not like he's touched me all that much in public either, unless you count dancing in the streets of New Orleans or that time in Vail, and there was a fair amount of alcohol involved in both.
It just feels rude or something,
Alex tries to explain. Rude? Trey lights a cigarette.
We're all adults, man. Hold on to your girl if you want.
Sarah snorts. Don't bother. This has been a years-long conversation. I've accepted my lot. I'm going to marry a man who hates holding hands. My chest jolts at the word marry. Is it really that serious between them? I mean, obviously it's serious, but they haven't been back together that long. Trey and I talk about marriage occasionally, but in a lofty, far-off, maybe, who knows, let's not put pressure on this way.
Now that I can understand,
Trey says, blowing his cigarette smoke away from us.
Hand-holding sucks. It's not comfortable, and it limits movement, and in a crowd it's inconvenient. Like you might as well just handcuff your ankles together.
Not to mention your hands get all sweaty, Alex says. It's all around uncomfortable.
I love holding hands, I chime in, tucking the word marry deep inside my brain to puzzle over later. Especially in a crowd. It makes me feel safe. Well, it looks like if we go into Florence before this trip is over, Sarah says, it's gonna be me and Poppy holding hands, and you two lone wolves getting utterly lost in the masses. Sarah holds her wine glass out to me, and I clink mine to hers, and we both laugh. And that might be the first moment that I like her. That I realize maybe I could have liked her all along if I hadn't been holding so tight to Alex that there was no room for her. I have to stop doing that. I decide I will, and from then on, the wine takes over, and all four of us are talking, joking, laughing, and this night sets the tone for the rest of the trip. Long, sunny days wandering every old town spread out around us, driving to vineyards and swirling glasses of wine with our mouths held ajar to inhale their deep, fruity scent. Late lunches in ancient stone buildings with world-renowned chefs. Alex leaving bright and early each morning to run. Trey dipping out not much later to scout locations or capture photos he's already planned. Sarah and I sleeping in most days, then meeting for a long swim, or to float on rafts with plastic cups full of limoncello and vodka, talking about nothing too important, but with far more ease than that day at Linfield's lone Mediterranean restaurant. At night, we go out for late dinners and wine, then come back to our villa's patio and talk and drink until it's nearly morning. We play every game we recognize from the closet full of them. Lawn games like bocce and badminton, and board games like Clue and Scrabble and Monopoly, which I happen to know Alex hates, though he doesn't admit that when Trey suggests we play. We stay up later and later each night. We scribble celebrities' names onto pieces of paper, mix them up, and stick them to our foreheads for a game of 20 questions in which we guess who's on our heads, with the added obstacle of every question asked requiring another drink. It quickly becomes obvious that none of us has the same celebrity references, which makes the game 200 times harder, but also funnier. When I ask if my celebrity is a reality TV star, Sarah pretends to gag. Really? I say. I love reality TV. It's not like I'm unused to this reaction, but part of me feels like her disapproval equals Alex's disapproval, and a sore spot appears along with an urge to press on it. I don't know how you can watch that stuff, Sarah says.
I know, Trey says lightly. I've never understood her interest either. It's at odds with every other thing about her, but P's all about The Bachelor.
Not all about it, I say, defensive. I started watching a couple seasons ago with Rachel when a girl from her art program was a contestant, and within 3 or 4 episodes, I was hooked. I just think it's like this incredible experiment, I explain. And you get to watch hours of the footage compiled in it. You learn so much about people. Sarah's eyebrows flick up. Like what narcissists are willing to do for fame?
Trey laughs, dead on.
I force out a laugh, take another sip of my wine. Not what I was talking about. I shift uncomfortably, trying to figure out how to explain myself. I mean, there's a lot that I like. But one thing, I like how in the end, it seems like it's actually a hard decision for some people. There will be two or three contestants they feel a strong connection with, and it doesn't just come down to choosing the strongest one. Instead, it's like you're watching them choose a life. And that's how it is in real life, too. You can love someone and still know the future you'd have with them wouldn't work for you, or for them, or maybe even for both of you.
But do any of those relationships really work out? Sarah asks.
Most don't, I admit, but that's not the point. You watch someone date all these people, and you see how different they are with each of them, and then you watch them choose. Some people choose the person they have the best chemistry with, or that they have the most fun with, and some choose the one they think will make an amazing father, or who they've felt the safest opening up to. It's fascinating how so much of love is about who you are with someone.
I love who I am with Trey. I'm confident and independent, flexible and cool-headed. I'm at ease. I'm the person I always dreamed I would be.
Fair. Sarah allows. It's the part about making out with like 30 guys and then getting engaged to someone you've met 5 times that's harder for me to swallow.
Trey tips his head back, laughing.
You'd totally sign up for that show if we broke up, wouldn't you, P?
Now that I would watch, Sarah says, giggling.
I know he's joking around, but it irks me, feeling like they're united against me. I think about saying, why do you think that? Because I'm a narcissist who's willing to do anything to get famous?
Alex bumps his leg into mine under the table, and when I glance at him, he's not even looking my way. He's just reminding me that he's here, that nothing can really hurt me. I bite down on my words and let it go.
More wine?
The next night, we eat a long, late dinner out on the terrace. When I go inside to dish up gelato for dessert, I find Alex standing in the kitchen reading an email. He has just gotten word that Tin House accepted one of his stories. He looks so happy, so brilliantly himself, that I sneak a picture of him. I love it so much I would probably set it as my background if both of us were single, and that wasn't extremely weird for both Sarah and Trey. We decide we have to celebrate, as if that isn't what this whole trip has been, and Trey makes us mojitos, and we sit out on the chaise longues overlooking the valley, listening to the soft, twinkly sounds of nighttime in the countryside. I barely sip on my drink. I've been nauseated all night, and for the first time, I excuse myself to go to sleep long before the others. Trey climbs into bed hours later, tipsy and kissing on my neck, pulling on me. And after we have sex, he falls asleep immediately, and my nausea comes back. That's when it occurs to me. I was supposed to start my period at some point on this trip. Probably it's a fluke. There are a lot of reasons to wind up nauseated while traveling internationally, and Trey and I are fairly careful. Still, I get out of bed, stomach roiling, and tiptoe downstairs, opening my notes app to see when I was expecting my period. Rachel's constantly telling me to get this period tracker app, but until now, I haven't really seen the point. My ears are pounding, my heart is racing, my tongue feels too big for my mouth. I was supposed to start yesterday. A 2-day delay isn't unheard of. Nausea after drinking buckets of red wine isn't either. Especially for a migraineur, but still, I'm freaking out. I grab my jacket off the coat rack, stuff my feet into sandals, and take the rental car keys. The nearest 24-hour grocery store is 38 minutes away. I make it back to the villa with 3 different pregnancy tests before the sun has even started to rise. By then, I'm in a full-blown panic. All I can do is pace back and forth on the terrace, gripping the most expensive pregnancy test in one hand and reminding myself to inhale, exhale, inhale. My lungs feel worse than they did when I had pneumonia.
Couldn't sleep?
A quiet voice startles me. Alex is leaned against the open door in a pair of black shorts and running shoes,
his pale body cast blue by the pre-dawn. A laugh dies in my throat. I'm not sure why. Are you getting up to run?
It's cooler before the sun's up.
I nod, wrap my arms around myself, and turn back to gaze over the valley. Alex comes to stand beside me, and without looking over at him, I start to cry. He reaches out for my hand and unfurls it to see the pregnancy test clenched there. For 10 seconds, he is silent. We are both silent.
Have you taken one yet?
He asks softly. I shake my head and start to cry harder. He pulls me in, wraps his arms around my back as I let my breath out in a few rushes of quiet sobs. It eases some of the pressure, and I draw back from him, wiping my eyes with the heels of my hands.
What am I going to do, Alex? I ask him. What the hell am I supposed to do?
He studies my face for a long time.
What do you want to do?
I wipe at my eyes again.
I don't think Trey wants to have kids.
That's not what I asked,
Alex murmurs.
I have no idea what I want, I admit. I mean, I want to be with him. And maybe someday, I don't know. I don't know.
I bury my face in my hands as a few more ugly, soundless sobs work out of me.
I'm not strong enough to do that on my own. I can't. I couldn't even handle being sick by myself, Alex. How am I supposed to?
He takes my wrists gently and pulls them away from my face, ducking his head to peer into my eyes.
Poppy, he says, you won't be alone, okay? I'm here.
So what? I say. I'd like move to Indiana? Get an apartment next door to you and Sarah? How's that gonna work, Alex?
I don't know, he admits. It doesn't matter how. I'm here. Just go take the test, and then we'll figure it out, okay? You'll figure out what you want to do, and we'll do it.
I take a deep breath, nod, go inside with the bag of tests I've set down on the ground and the one I'm still gripping like a life raft. I pee on 3 at once, then take them all back outside to wait. We line them up on the low stone wall surrounding the terrace. Alex sets a timer on his watch, and we stand there